From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Last night, the Senate passed a $4 trillion budget resolution that sets the stage for Republicans to vote on their tax cut plan, which is being written behind closed doors. So a victory for President Trump there, but a combative week otherwise. The president got into a fight with both a storied veteran, John McCain, and another Gold Star family. His chief of staff, who's also a Gold Star dad, stepped into the ring as well. And we heard from two former presidents who seem to be saying, everyone go back to your corners and take a time out.
So let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. And joining us today, Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor at Telemundo and NBC. Hi, Jose.
Hey, guys. How are you?
I'm doing well. And Domenico Montanaro is with us as well, NPR lead politics editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. And let's get into some of the nitty-gritty politics here first. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul was the only Republican no vote on the budget last night, which people see as the route to a tax overhaul. Many more Republicans have expressed concerns about the GOP tax plan that is being written behind closed doors. How likely is passage of tax cuts at this point, Domenico?
I think that it's something that is still a little bit of a ways away, and this process always takes some time, and there are a lot of things that Congress still has to get through to be able to get it passed. I don't think that we can say necessarily that because the budget resolution passes that automatically means tax cuts or that the tax overhaul is coming as well. You know, this is a much bigger issue with a lot of different priorities tied up in it, and there's a reason that a tax overhaul hasn't been passed for 30 years.
Well, President tweeted out this morning that even though Rand Paul was against the budget, he's going to vote for the tax cuts. So we'll keep an eye on that. But meanwhile, big news this week. President Trump's chief of staff, a Gold Star father, John Kelly, appeared unannounced for the second week in a row at the White House press briefing yesterday to comment on this flare-up between President Trump and the family of LaDavid Johnson, one of the soldiers killed in Niger. That family sent their congresswoman and close family friend out to talk to the press about what Trump said in that phone call to the family. The president was excoriated for telling the widow, by many, excoriated by many, for telling the widow her guy knew what he signed up for. But General Kelly described what he was told when his son died and what advice he gave Trump.
I said to him, sir, there's nothing you can do to lighten the burden on these families. And let me tell you what my best friend Joe Dunford told me, because he was my casualty officer. He said, Kel, he was doing exactly what he wanted to do when he was killed. He knew what he was getting into.
So, Jose, President Trump apparently said the same thing to the widow of LaDavid Johnson. Your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, it just seems as though this is more than just semantics. It's just feeling. And I think that what Kelly was saying yesterday is that, you know, this has to be just one of the most difficult things that anybody can do, call someone when they have lost a loved one in the battlefield. And so I think that, you know, it is too bad. I think that I think I would have to agree with General Kelly. It is too bad that that politics are being used. I mean, you know, people are being used for political gain on both sides of this issue, with something so raw and so difficult as losing a loved one, no?
Yeah, absolutely. But it also, Domenico, it seems like almost every week among the stories that we're talking about, there's something like this where President Trump gets into a fight, basically, with someone. And we try to determine why would he say things to that person the way that he did.
You know, President Trump may have had the best of intentions here. You know, he probably wanted to do something that he felt was sympathetic and goes above and beyond maybe what he sees as what others may have done. But there's a reason why General Kelly in that press conference said that he told the president, don't call. That was my advice, he said. That's my advice. Don't call, because this is a very difficult thing to do. You know, you have to take this very seriously. And if you're not used to doing this kind of thing, if you're not used to showing this kind of empathy, if there's any kind of trickiness in doing this at all, it's probably best to leave it to the professionals and the people that know how to do this and who
and they're trained to do this.
Time.
I mean, they really are trained to do it.
Well, and we had some conversation last night with on Twitter. I did, and people were saying that Perhaps one of the problems here is that it's one thing for a military officer to say to another military officer, General Kelly, you know better than anybody, your son was doing what he wanted to do. But for that to be said to a widow, you know, that's hers to say, you know, whether or not he was doing what he wanted to do. But putting that aside and putting aside all the questions raised about Niger and why it took 12 days and why this particular soldier was the one who was somehow left behind. Here we have this Congresswoman, Frederica Wilson, who was a close friend of the families, it turns out. She's known this soldier since he was born. He was in her mentor program. She was in the limo going to get the body because she is such a close family friend. And here you have both Kelly saying that he was appalled at this congresswoman and Trump saying she was secretly listening. My question to you, Jose, what does this say about the Trump White House that they, Kelly and Trump, did not know this about this woman? Isn't there someone whose job it is to kind of smooth these moments, to do that research and
probably John Kelly. That's probably his job.
Yeah, I think it's – I mean, look, I think the bigger answer to that is it's many times a mess. And you know, messaging is a mess in the White House, and it's been, you know, since the first days of this administration. It really is a mess and, you know, contradictory statements. The press secretary says one thing, and then the president, you know, hours or minutes later kind of, you know, changes the narrative. And then the press secretary says, well, that's what I meant he meant, and the words are different. But on this specific issue, I don't know how you can prepare. I mean, you know, does the White House call and say, hi, the president's going to be calling, no one else can be listening? I don't think that that's part, you know, when you're calling to speak to someone who's lost a loved one, I don't know how much, you know, pre-planning there can be on that. Clearly, they knew that the president was going to call.
Right.
I mean, but more than that, I mean, lay down the rules of a conversation?
It was on a speakerphone. It was being held by a soldier in the limo.
Yeah. I do think that it, you know, anyway, this is just an opinion. I don't
and
think
Robin,
this is
as you were. Yeah. And Robin, as you were getting to, I think the bigger questions here, you know, is that this week we've wound up losing focus of what actually matters here, which is, what happened in Niger? Why are U.S. troops abroad in places like Niger? Why were there 50 ISIS members who were able to, you know, ambush Americans in an unarmored vehicle? There's a lot more to this. And for all the Republicans who had lots of questions about Benghazi, you would think that they're going to want to have questions about what happened here.
Well, we need to put a little bit of focus while we have you guys on what we heard from two former presidents this week about divisions in politics. First, here's President George W. Bush seeming to take a swipe at President Trump without mentioning him by name.
Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication.
And here's former President Obama stepping back out on the campaign trail.
We are rejecting a politics of division. We are rejecting a politics of fear. That we are embracing a politics that says everybody counts.
Jose, what did you make of those moments?
Well, they spoke very similar words. And I think that the fact that President Bush was speaking in a nonpartisan, kind of non-political setting gave his words, I think, even and they're, you know, the same political party as President Trump. There was another line that Bush said that I think that is also important. He said people of every race, religion and ethnicity can be fully and equally American, and that bigotry or white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed. I think that was even a bigger attack on what we've been seeing in our body politic and many times coming out of the White House than anything President Obama said, even though he said it in a political forum, you know, President Obama. President Bush, I think, was really stinging and very real in some of the things that he brought up.
Well, you know, you're seeing a crack up in our American politics.
Yes.
We're cracking into four parties, really. Hmm. And President Obama and President Bush represent two of the pragmatic centrist parties, the center-right pragmatists and the center-left pragmatists, and you have this populism nexus that sort of is stretched behind each other with liberal populism and conservative populism that Donald Trump represents and that Bernie Sanders represents on the other side. And President Bush took a shot at both of those philosophies and worldviews, basically mm-hmm. saying that young people don't understand the moral clarity of the Cold War because they seem more okay with socialist central planning. Now, no one necessarily would accuse Bernie Sanders of wanting to be a central planner, but the implication there was clear that mm-hmm. he's saying that the country is changing and not changing for the better.
Well, Domenico, those are strong words to go into the weekend with, a crack up in American politics, but that's exactly what Steve Bannon wants.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and so does Russia, to be perfectly honest, right? I mean, this is something, that a wedge that the Russians have tried to sow, whether it's in division or white cultural grievance and the number of kind of trolls and all that have popped up on social media mm-hmm. And that we're going to be hearing a lot more about in Congress next week.
And a lot of people in the 8th of November apparently want it as well.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That's Jose Diaz-Balart from Telemundo and NBC and Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
This is Here and Now.
I want to play airplane.
That you and I.
I want to play airplane.
That you and I.
I want to play airplane.
That's music from Fun Home, the 2015 Tony Award winner for Best Musical. It's based on the graphic novel by cartoon artist Alison Bechdel. In it, an adult Alison looks back at her life growing up as a lesbian in a small Pennsylvania town. Her father was also gay, but closeted, and his secrecy would come to affect the entire family. Fun Home is now on tour. Kate Schindel plays the adult Alison. She joins us in the studio. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So what drew you to this show?
First and foremost, it's a great piece of theater. I was drawn to the character and her particular evolution over the course of this show because she is trying to make sense of her past. She's trying to solve the mystery of her father's death. She is cerebral and artistic and all kinds of things that are always interesting to me as an actor. And because there are really prominent LGBTQ themes in the show, I also felt like it was a huge opportunity to tell this story at this cultural moment all across America.
Well, what do you think that this show brings to that question of coming out and being gay that other shows, because that's a theme that comes up in some shows at the moment. What do you think this one brings that the others don't?
I wouldn't make a blanket statement about what every show is like, but I think that ours really turns a compassionate eye toward the journey that a young person goes through, or an older person, certainly. But in our show, the coming out narrative is a college freshman. And Alison, we see her at three points in her life, mm-hmm. as a child, as a college freshman, and then as an adult looking back. And there are some things that really resonate with me. For example, when Medium Alison tells her parents that that she's going through this, they say things that I think a lot of well-intentioned people say, like, well, don't rush to put a label on it, or maybe everyone should experiment, but do you really want to call yourself that right away? And I just, you know, I feel like I hope people who feel that way come and see our show, because I don't think they recognize how detrimental that can be to the process of someone coming out. And we see it in pretty stark relief, the difference between Alison going through that process and recognizing and owning her own identity, and her father, who never was able to do that because he was in a small town in Pennsylvania and felt like he had to stay in the closet.
Have you heard from people who have seen the show? I mean, you've been in more than 20 cities at this point. Have you talked to people like that who have seen the show and are in that situation?
Absolutely. We meet them at the stage door quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And often they're teenagers who are trying to figure out where they fit. And they tell me that they cried through the entire show just because of the recognition of their own lives on stage. And I don't, you know, I hope that most people don't come to the theater and cry through the entire show. I mean, it's an entertaining and funny mm-hmm. and engaging and thoughtful piece. But for some, especially young people, that thing that that tells them from the stage that we see them and that they matter is really moving.
As you mentioned, you're one of three Allisons. Mm-hmm. Two other actresses play Allison at different points in her life. Let's listen to a little of small Allison, who's enthralled by a woman she sees in a diner. What's it like to have three people playing the same role? Did you get together and decide how you were all going to play Allison?
Yeah, we figured out the handshake. No, you know, we all rehearsed together. And I think that I take subtle cues from them, and I'm sure that they do as well. You know, the costumes are reminiscent of each other. There are a couple sort of Easter eggs of these are all the same person sprinkled throughout the show. But ultimately, we're all playing the same character, but at very different points in her life. And Ring of Keys is particularly moving because it comes late in the show. I think it's been interesting to see in different parts of the country the responses to that number in particular. Hmm. Small Allison sees someone in a diner who she recognizes. And I don't even think it's particularly a song of sexual attraction or physical romantic attraction. It's just, there's this thing I've been trying to figure out about myself, and that looks like it. And I want to try and get to the root of why in the way that a child's mind might work. It's just a remarkable feat of writing, as far as I'm concerned. And it goes over differently depending on where you are.
Years ago, before I was doing what I'm doing now, I was in a community theater production of Our Town.
Oh, yeah?
And played the stage manager. Mm-hmm. And your role kind of reminded me of the stage manager in Our Town, because you're sort of watching everything that's going on, but you're also a participant. I want to listen to one of your songs here. This is called Maps.
Mm-hmm. Maps show you what is simple and true. Try laying out a bird's eye view. Not what he told you, just what you see. What do you know that's not your dad's mythology?
There's a lot of pain in this show.
Yeah.
Is it difficult to do that night after night, to go through that?
It can be, but the interesting thing to me is that last time I toured, it's been a while, I toured with the Roundabout production of Cabaret, the last time it was out, about 15 years ago. And at the end of that show, I found it hard to shake it off because you could argue that things don't turn out well for Sally at the end, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a pretty devastating ending. And at the end of Fun Home, I feel like Allison's really reached a point where she is able to value and treasure the positive moments, even in the face of the challenging and intense stuff that permeated her relationship with her father. So when I leave the stage after finishing Fun Home, I feel pretty good.
You've also performed on Broadway. Do you prefer touring to performing in one place all the time?
It depends on the show, and sometimes it depends on the day. You know, there are definitely built-in challenges with touring. You just sort of take away all the comforts of home in one fell swoop. This time around, I bought a car so that I could drive the tour instead of just flying from city to city, specifically so I could see a lot of the in-between, you know, and that's been awesome. You know, there are things that you can do, like when you're in one place for 6 weeks, get an apartment. Don't stay in a hotel so that you have to wash dishes in the sink for 6 weeks.
So you're doing
weeks.
A lot of Airbnbs or something
I've
like that.
I've done some Airbnbs. Yeah.
And does the show change at all based on what city you're in?
We're pretty consistent. And I feel like it's important with our show not to apologize for it. The reception, like, here's a good example. There's one line just before Ring of Keys where I, as adult Allison, say about the woman that small Allison sees. She was an old school butch. And in some places, people don't know what to do with that word. They laugh at it. That's in San Francisco and Seattle, nobody laughed. It's just a thing that is. It's a word that is commonplace, and it's just a definition of a certain set of characteristics. So, yeah, you do get sort of an uncomfortable laugh here and there, or a rousing round of applause in some places and not others. But in general, we try to keep the show what the show is.
Now, even though it is almost completely hidden from your bio in the program,
yeah,
you were Miss America.
Yeah, I was once upon a time.
And you had to tour as Miss America, too. I have to ask you about the difference between touring in a show like this and touring as Miss America.
Different.
Which
different.
Can be grueling.
I traveled about 20,000 miles a month that year. And I was 20, so I didn't know how to get tired or how to observe time zones. And 90% of what I did that year was HIV/AIDS activism.
Right.
So I was showing up on the morning news and then going to an assembly of, 300 ninth graders where I would talk to them about staying safe from HIV, then go do a fundraiser that night for a local AIDS charity. I mean, there was a lot more moving around that year.
You were a controversial Miss America.
I guess so. I mean, I it depends on who you ask. To me, I've always felt from the time I started getting involved with the AIDS issue that there was a right and a wrong. By 1997, 1998, we knew what caused AIDS. Mm-hmm. We knew how to stop it. And the reasons that we didn't were primarily political and fear-based. And I think that's wrong. I think that when you're dealing with something like that, where needle exchange, for example, was a big topic of conversation that year, where you can look at empirical evidence that needle exchange programs reduce the spread of HIV among IV drug users, but they don't have a corresponding increase on the amount of IV drug use, then you should do it. Whether or not people are anecdotally afraid that they're giving tacit approval for people to shoot heroin, the statistics don't bear that out. And I felt the same way about comprehensive sex education versus abstinence-based health education. One works and the other doesn't. So I guess it was unusual at that time for a Miss America to be talking about some of those things. At the same time, by that point, it wasn't controversial anymore or particularly interesting for anyone to just wear a red ribbon and say, let's spread awareness. We were all aware. It was just time to do something about it.
That's actress Kate Schindel, who stars in the touring production of the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home. You can find more information on the show at hereandnow.org. It's a great show. Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Daddy, hey, Daddy, come here, okay? I need you. What are you doing? I said, come here. You need to do what I tell you to do. Listen to me. Daddy, come here. Hey, right here, right now. You're making me mad. Listen to me. Listen to me. Listen to me.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
A study out this week finds the population of flying insects in Germany has dropped by 75% over the last 27 years. Scientists used bottles to collect insects in German nature reserves to do their study. Kaspar Hollmann is the lead author. He's a PhD student at Radboud University in the Netherlands and joins us on Skype. Kaspar, which insects are we talking about?
It encompasses pretty much everything that flies around, from leaf-chewing insects all the way to wasps, bees, dragonflies, parasitoids, you name it. It's the entire spectrum of everything that flies.
So what's the reason for this drop-off? Have you figured that out?
We've looked at three possible causes, which was climate change, landscape change, or habitat changes. So climate change is known to affect insects. Landscape changes are known to be able to change the landscape and therefore, provide an inhospitable area for the insects. And then habitat changes, for example, insects like open areas. So if the area becomes a forested area, then you're going to, see a drop off an insect, of course. So we looked at those factors as possible explanations for the drop off, but none of them could really explain the drop off of 75%. Now, take, for example, temperature. That's slightly increased in the same areas over the past three decades. And because we know that the flying insects actually love high temperatures, we should have expected an increase in insect biomass over the past 3 years instead of a drop. So we sort of say, okay, this cannot be it. There must be something else going on. Of course, there is a number of suspects still there, which we could not stripe off. That includes the agriculture, intensification, and pollution as most prominent ones.
And what do you think are the effects of this? If you've got a 75% drop-off in the population of flying insects, how is that going to manifest itself down the food chain?
Well, that's one of the things that really worrying. 75% drop is a dramatic thing. I mean, so many species of birds, amphibians, bats, small mammals rely on insects as a food source. If you're going to take three quarters away, you are bound to have difficulties in the higher trophical levels. But that's not only it. You should also think about pollination of the wild plants. They also depend on insects. And even more important, but less appreciated, is all the nutrient cycle that happens. Think of breaking down the nutrients, which will be taken up by the ecosystem again. That also depends on insects. Losing three quarters of them must be detrimental for the entire ecosystem.
So is there any recommendation about what should be done to reverse this trend, or you just don't know enough about what's causing it yet?
Yeah, well, ideally, you would like to pinpoint the exact cause or causes that are responsible for this decline. We were unable to do it at this point. At the same time, however, we know two things. We know what is beneficial for insects, and we know what's detrimental to insects, and both can be done something about. So we could try, for example, to set in place areas with flower-rich grasslands and management in a way that it will be beneficial for the insects. And at the same time, we should try to minimize negative impacts from, for example, agriculture intensification. And by that, I hint at pesticide use and over excessive use of fertilizers and those things.
That's Caspar Hallman, who is the lead author of a new study published this week in the journal PLOS. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. Caspar, thank you.
So much thank you, too.
In western Massachusetts and Connecticut, there's a small chain of stores that sells the odd combination of soda and pet supplies. People love the quirky owner, Dave, but now many are turning on him because they think he supports repealing Obamacare. He doesn't. So how did this happen? Alden Bourne from New England Public Radio starts our look.
People will have great, great health care.
Last Thursday, President Trump signed an executive order at the White House, which would impact the Affordable Care Act. One part of that order?
To allow more small businesses to form associations to buy affordable and competitive health insurance.
Standing behind the president was Dave Ratner. He owns 7 Dave Soda and Pet City stores in western Massachusetts and northern Connecticut. He says he was invited to the event by the National Retailers Association because he's a small businessman who's long advocated for the small business change.
Petco, PetSmart, Costco, all these chains with huge amount of employees, they go out and they bargain with the insurance companies. Dave or the plumber or the barbershop goes out to try and get health insurance for their employees. We don't have anywhere near the bargaining power, so we pay way more.
But Ratner says he wasn't aware beforehand of the full impact on Obamacare of what Trump was signing. And he says he had no idea that Trump would later that day also order that federal health insurance subsidies be cut.
In my particular case, had I known that he was going to announce that he's dismantling Obamacare, I never would have gone.
The reaction to Ratner's White House appearance has been swift. Many people have posted angry messages on the Dave's Soda and Pet City Facebook page, and someone started an online petition calling for a boycott. And Ratner says customers are also venting their feelings in person.
We've had some people screaming at our employees. You know, how could your boss do this? What kind of person is he?
Ratner says he's feeling the strain.
Said to my wife last night, I said, listen, I just want you to know I love you. I just, you know, in case I don't wake up, in case I just drop dead while I'm sleeping.
Ratner insists he's not a Trump supporter, that he voted for Hillary Clinton. He wrote a letter to the local paper and sent an email to his customers saying he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. and he's flabbergasted by what's come of it all.
Why people are taking it out on me for going to Washington to do something that I thought was going to do good for millions of people. I just don't get it.
The White House offered no comment on how much Ratner or the other retailers knew about exactly what was in the executive order. But a spokesperson sent a statement saying that the changes would help American businesses and their employees access lower-cost insurance. For Here and Now, I'm Alden Bourne.
And Alden's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. What a terrible dilemma for Dave. The picture of him standing right next to President Trump applauding as the president holds up his executive order has gone viral. In the age of social media, a small social media blaze like that can become a conflagration in a second. When New Balance tweeted praise for some of President Trump's trade policies, a white supremacist declared New Balance the official shoes of white people. When a disgruntled employee fills her social media with disparaging labor accusations, firms like Comcor Consulting say, pity the company that's not prepared. What Comcor does is gather company employees in a war room and design a fake crisis for them to react to, and then they fan the flames as employees sweat, swear, and struggle through. Dale Weiss is senior vice president at Comcor. He helped design the company's pressure test simulation training. Dale, you ran a simulation for the New York Times, gave them a fake scenario in which one of their investors was a polluter. Then you hammered them with, what, fake phone calls, even news reports on the TV?
Yeah, and it's more than just the hammering part, and that certainly is innovative. It's really for companies and organizations to understand that they can be in the bullseye by doing absolutely nothing wrong. And typically, if you don't really plan ahead and have an idea of what you're going to do, how the team is going to work it, the crisis can overtake you pretty quickly.
Right. So we understand that you sometimes wake up in the middle of the night with simulation ideas, things that you can torture companies with during these sessions. Give us some examples.
Well, I do wake up at 2 in the morning for that. It's the notepad next to the desk that where I think of most of it. Phone calls, knocking on doors, ambush interviews, fake news reports happening, change.org petitions rolling, and all kinds of other activist activity happening on social media. We wouldn't necessarily go to a manufacturer and say, okay, we're going to do a product recall or a strike. They're probably pretty good at that. Mm-hmm. But we compound things, as you said, with disgruntled employees, with things that can happen so quickly unless they get ahead of it. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. In 2011, we worked with an automotive company and actually started simulating the problems of telematics, and you know, how cars can talk to other cars and how that can get hacked. And when we did it, they go, oh, no, that could never be. And then obviously 6 months later, things started to happen. Articles were written. And then we have seen instances of hackers going into the telematics of automobiles and having it do things. In a crisis, we like to talk about the three Fs, which is being fast, flexible, and factual. In the middle of it, it can be hard to get ahead. So often, companies get stalled and bogged down on how to even release a simple statement. And before you know it, social media, which works at the speed of light, can get so far ahead of you that it's hard to catch up.
Mm. We hear that traditionally, companies are advised by lawyers, don't even acknowledge it. You say what?
We love it when the lawyers are in the room actually being part of the drill because they can see how out of control things get and they can see that speed is important in trying to get your message out because there's the emergency part of it and there's the communications part of it. You can have a newspaper, and the way we worked one scenario was there was an international steel company that was called a big polluter. The way the newspaper is involved is they're a publicly traded company. Their second largest institutional investor just bought a controlling interest in this particular steel company that is alleged to be a large polluter. Now what you have is activist groups putting the two together and saying, hey, the newspaper should divest out of this and not let this institutional company invest in them. Well, the newspaper has no control over that. And before you know it, you have all kinds of social media that are saying, you're supposed to be so credible, but yet you are indirectly and directly involved in this large polluter. Mm. That's just how it can begin.
Talk about what happens around that table while you're, you know, assaulting these executives and, you know, these people from a company with the attacks from the outside, social media, news reporters. Mm. How are they talking about solving it?
Typically, they're discussing. It takes too long.
Right.
Legal steps in and starts talking about, well, we can't have any liability. We can't admit to anything here. The speed of social media is the speed of light. And they get behind the curb.
Right.
And when they start getting themselves organized, and it usually takes about halfway through the scenario, they start to delegate. They start to move faster. They start to get information out. They identify the types of channels. It's not just creating a statement, but are you going to send it on your Twitter page? Do you have a dark site? Do you want to create a fast YouTube message? All of these things happen, and they start happening quickly. Important to know in a simulation, though, especially, there typically is not a winner or a loser. It enables them to understand the process better and allows them to react quicker when the crisis eventually does happen.
The New York Times reporter who went through this simulation with you talks about feeling completely out of control, hands sweating, you know, heart pounding, realizing that at the end of the simulation, I think the paper like goes under or something. They lose such control over the situation. I'm guessing you see some people unravel pretty quickly.
People do unravel. Sometimes we'll see organizations saying, yeah, we're really good at this. We got this. No problem. But we should do this anyway. And then they see they don't have this correctly. And sometimes, actually, when we create these simulations, they over-respond. They make the situation worse before it gets worse.
Dale Weiss, you've been described as being gleeful as you think up these scenarios for companies to go through in these sessions.
Let's call it creative.
Okay.
Just, I like to push the envelope in ways that they don't expect.
Well, that's life. Dale Weiss, Senior Vice President at Comcor Consulting, a firm that runs crisis simulation events for corporations to help prepare them for damage control for situations they can't even imagine. Dale, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, said today that nearly 340,000 Rohingya children are living in squalid conditions in Bangladesh. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims fled Myanmar, also known as Burma, for Bangladesh when violence broke out in late August. They say the government is engaged in a systematic campaign to eliminate them. Myanmar says it's responding to attacks by Rohingya insurgents. Joining us now is Eric Schwartz, president of Refugees International. He's in Washington. And Eric, you were just in these refugee camps in Bangladesh. What did you see? What are the conditions?
They are as difficult and terrible as you could possibly imagine. First of all, Bangladesh is one of the most densely populated countries in the world. They're in the rainy season there, so people are living in really squalor, in makeshift facilities that have sprung up literally everywhere in the region. The conditions, the risk of disease is huge, and the conditions are as challenging as you could possibly imagine.
Do the Rohingya Muslims there expect to go back to Myanmar?
Well, the truth is the people that we spoke to expressed a desire to go back to their homes, even though their homes are gone. I think that they would need to have some degree of confidence that they could go back in conditions of safety and security. But I think, you know, like anyone who's driven from their homes, people want to go back. You know, the situation in Rakhine State in Burma, it is as bad a situation as I have ever seen in some 30 years of doing these kinds of missions.
And the de facto leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize winner, has come under a lot of criticism over this crisis. Should the rest of the world be pressing her harder to stop it? Is there something that she could do?
Well, I think the short answer is yes, there is something she could do. It's also fair to say that the Burmese military is very much the upper hand here. Right? They are driving the situation, and one can question how strongly Aung San Suu Kyi should be condemning the actions of the military. But my concern is, whatever she decides about how strongly she's going to speak out publicly, it is an extreme source of disappointment that she has largely served as an apologist for the military. She has challenged whether there is discrimination in Rakhine State. Of course there's discrimination. There's been discrimination. She has professed a certain ignorance about the extent of human rights violations, and that kind of ignorance can only be willful. And so my concern is that if she's not going to be the pointy edge of the spear in terms of challenging the military, she shouldn't be an apologist for the military.
What should the United States be doing about this?
Action has got to be extremely strong from the international community. And thus far, my concern is that the responses have been completely inadequate. The United States needs to take tough measures. Number one, the U.S. needs continually and at the highest level to be condemning these human rights abuses, to be insisting that they come to an end, to be insisting on the agreement of return for Rohingya when conditions permit, to permit unfettered access to the area. We also should be pressing for a multilateral arms embargo on the regime, sanctions against military leaders, to demonstrate that the world is not prepared to accept this. And that kind of very tough and consistent outrage has got to be a central component of any effort to challenge what is happening.
Why isn't that happening yet?
Well, I mean, the truth is you have to ask people in the administration. But, you know, I think that, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, these are a brown-skinned Muslim population thousands and thousands of miles away from the United States. And it is a tragedy. It's a human tragedy that the principle of humanity, that every individual matters, whether he's across the street or across the world, is not prevailing in this case. And that is a stain on humanity. And we have to do everything we can to reverse that.
And you compare it to the Rwandan genocide in the 90s.
When Bill Clinton lamented the absence of a response when he went to Rwanda in 1998, he said that our mistake was we didn't call it what it was. And that was a critical mistake, because if you call it what it is, then you permit the kind of outrage that that then enables the kind of response that the world needs to make. And my concern was, in testimony before the House of Representatives a week or two ago, the members of Congress couldn't get the State Department's Asia representative to acknowledge that ethnic cleansing was taking place. The most they could get was a statement saying that this was a cauldron of complexities. And that's the kind of language that doesn't permit the kind of outrage and response that is necessary in this particular instance.
That's Eric Schwartz, who is president of Refugees International. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.